Good afternoon, everybody. Why don't we go ahead and get started now that I've worked my way through the technology there a little bit. I'm David Pumphrey. I'm the Deputy Director and Senior Fellow with the Energy and National Security Program here at CSIS. And it's really a great pleasure to have this panel come together and to talk about the issues related to the environmental impacts of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. As many of you know, we've done a number of sessions. I think we are counting up this morning that this is our seventh session around the Deepwater Horizon spill, and much of that has been focused on the technology, the industry response, the new safety measures, but we have not really had a chance to look at the environmental impacts and the issues that have come and the lessons learned in the process of doing the cleanup from this spill. So that's why we're very pleased to have David Kennedy, Assistant Administrator for the National Ocean Service from NOAA, with us. He was intimately involved in the process of the spill and I think can give us really good firsthand information about the process that they went through as well as some of the lessons learned to open up the discussion. And then we'll be followed by LG Holstein, Senior Director for Strategic Planning with the Environmental Defense Fund to do some commentary, and Juliet Alperin, staff writer with The Post, to also do commentary, and then we can open it up for commentary from the audience. So, David, if you would, I won't go through all the bios. I think everyone should have a copy there that you can see. That I think you'll see that David brings a wealth of experience to this question with the years at NOAA and looking at oil spill response issues. So, David, do you want me to work the?
Yeah, if you would.
I'll try to do that.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, okay. I'm sorry I have a bias. By saying I was 34 years old last April when they called me to go do Deepwater Horizon, and 3-plus months later and 7-day weeks and 12, 16 hours a day, now I look like I look, and I got to sit down because my knees are shot. But that doesn't work so good. but a wild, crazy time for everybody involved. So, yeah, I'm going to try and go through pretty quickly a set of slides talking about NOAA's role. And I get to a point in the presentation where there's a number of issues, and I think I want to spend a little bit more time on those. So if you would, next slide, please. So NOAA deeply involved in this event, and I won't spend any time here. This is our mission. And as we found in this particular event, even though we have a specific set of experts that work on oil spills within NOAA, really, by the time we got within the first few weeks of the spill, we had most of the types of expertise and products and services that NOAA uses engaged either directly or indirectly in helping support just what turned out to be a monumental effort. Next, please. So I think most of you are pretty familiar with the event, April 20. I happen to be in the Florida Keys, an Earth Day, and I got a call, which I always get whenever NOAA potentially be involved, that we had this event going on, and I kept saying, well, you know, this is something we've really, really never thought would happen. I'm sure this will be controlled quickly. 90-plus days later, 4.9 million barrels oil from 5,000 feet to the surface, 50 miles offshore, impacts of shoreline all along and on and on and on, turned into a monumental event, as I mentioned, for the nation and certainly for most all the federal agencies, NOAA being one that was involved from the very, very beginning. Next. So this was kind of our role. We have a standard role, as I say, where we actually directly support the Coast Guard and provide them a variety of different kinds of science, everything from chemistry, the impacts of oil in the water, and such things as oil spill modeling. We got involved in the modeling within the first couple of hours of this spill. I think 2 hours and 12 minutes after we were notified, the first model was actually run on the spill. We ran two models a day then from that point through, actually through well beyond when the oil was capped because, of course, we had huge amounts of oil still in the water. A variety of other things, resources at risk, we're trustees. We do environmental sensitivity index maps, how much impact you can expect depending on the kind of shoreline that is impacted and what the resources are there. and then what to do about trying to protect sensitive areas and so on and so on and so on. As this spill evolved, though, as I mentioned, the rest of NOAA got deeply involved beyond kind of this core team of experts that we had. And so in addition to the science to inform decision makers, and by the way, from that core set of issues we started getting into, and we'll talk about this later, not only hurricane prediction, but hurricane prediction as it relates to a hurricane in a monumental oil spill on the ocean. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, the behind-the-scenes effort that nobody really ever saw of this much oil in the water has the potential to affect hurricanes in general and how they form, and what can we do to generate the science to see just how much effect this much oil spread out on the water might really affect where a hurricane comes through. Then, of course, all the issues of if a hurricane comes through, what's going to happen to that oil that otherwise is being affected in different ways. Keeping seafood safe, huge issue in this spill, biggest ever. We ended up eventually closing over a third of the EEZ to fishing. Started out in small blocks, but they kept building and building to the point where 37% of the EEZ closed down. This was an effort with a variety of folks, and I've got a slide on each of these, so I'll get into it. But one of the challenges, interesting issues, and we've seen this over time, is it's one thing to close it down. It takes a fair amount of thinking through to decide what the protocols are going to be and the standards for closing down. But opening back up, oh, my God, that gets to be a much, much bigger problem because you've got all the consumer confidence, public interest issues. And so we'll get into that a little bit further. Wildlife and habitats, as I said, NOAA's a trustee. We had marine mammals, we had whales, we had dolphins, we had turtles, all of which were actually spotted in and about the slick and or oiled in other locations. And so the idea of beginning to look very carefully at what we were going to do to rescue those wildlife, how badly we thought they might be affected, and how we might even potentially, as in the case of turtles, move nests that we thought would be impacted other places so they'd have a chance of actually breeding and having young that wouldn't be in an area where there's oil. Another major component of NOAA is a federal trustee to do damage assessment. Damage assessment is, in essence, we have a substance that has impacted and potentially injured our natural trust resources. We have a legal responsibility to look very, very carefully at that injury to determine its scope, extent, and then come up with a plan of how that injury will be turned into restoring to pre-spill conditions what was injured. We are one of several federal trustees, in this case, Department of Interior, NOAA, the federal trustees. States are also trustees, and so every state in the Gulf, in this case, was part of what turned out to be the trustee council. The job from day one, along with the response and trying to figure what the impact was trying to get ahead of the actual event, get baseline data, and be on scene and conducting the science that would allow you to make the best possible case, quite frankly, if you have to go to court, for what you can ask, in this case BP, to give you in terms of reimbursement to restore all of the things that you can document are injured. And that gets to the restore damaged natural resources. Once we've made the case and have a plan, we actually then go ahead and execute that restoration. There's a whole plan that's developed that says the following resources were impacted in this way. Here's the best science that we currently have as to how and what you can do to restore. Here's the dollars we need to do it, and then actually going out and conducting that restoration. Next, please. So I've already talked about most of this, predicting where the oil goes, the sensitive habitats, and so on and so forth. This is really what I was suggesting in that first of several components that we do. You see a trajectory at the top there. This became kind of a nightly feature on every news report that I tuned into. One of the interesting things here is that whereas an awful lot, and we'll get into this a bit too, whereas an awful lot of the technology as it relates to cleaning up a spill and responding to a spill has changed virtually not at all. Some of the IT and satellite-type information actually has improved. And so this is one of the first times when the satellite technology had the kinds of resolution that we needed to really be extremely useful as we did our models. So we depended a lot on satellite technology as well as overflights and a variety of other things next. Talked about the Seafood Safe. This was not just a NOAA effort. NOAA has the trust, the trustee resource of the fish, but we don't do that alone. And FDA and EPA were both co-partners here as we had to coordinate then with each state as to, okay, what's the potential impact? How are we going to determine what we shut down? How is that going to be in concert with every federal agency and every state along the coast? You've got the states with their waters. You've got the feds with their waters. How do we all get on the same page so the public isn't thinking that the feds are shutting their fishery down, but the state isn't? So a massive effort just to coordinate how this was all going to be done. And then, of course, once you shut it down, how do you enforce that? How do you make sure that people don't go in? They did. They routinely did in the beginning, in part because getting the public word out as to where the closures were and what was going on was difficult. In many cases, we had other cultures that were fishing in the Gulf that didn't understand English. We had Vietnamese communities that truly didn't understand some of the bulletins. Early on, another major problem across all of this was communicating the science and the technical side of things. Early on, I was sent down because a bunch of communities were concerned about what we were doing and not understanding, and one of the first speakers got up and said, well, this is all on internet. Just get on your internet. The guy was booed off the stage. We don't have internet. What are you talking about, internet? You know, we want a poster up down at the post office. So a lot of issues like that. And then, as I said, reopening protocols. When we finally got to the point where we felt like oil was now no longer a threat in an area, the protocols that you had to put in place, the testing that had to be done, and there's a whole suite of tests that had to be conducted after you met the initial protocols, no oil in the arena for 30 days and so on and so forth. What you see here is, at the bottom, is a guy. The top area depicts a closure. At the bottom is what was first described to me as the initial test, organoleptic testing. And I said, oh, man, this is pretty sophisticated. That guy is sniffing that fish to see if he can sniff oil. And as it turns out, these are finely tuned noses that actually can detect parts per, I forget, but very, very low parts in a fish. And one of the first tests they always did was to sniff it. And from there, that was a go, no-go as to the next series of analyses that would be done next. I've talked some about this. I don't think I'll go much into it other than, again, the coordination from everybody. One, we were getting reports from every place that you had stranded, dead, dying. How do you go out and make sure that you can confirm or deny those things? And then how do you collect what's there? What's the protocol for making all of that work? Then where do you take these things for cleaning and rehabilitation? And then the longer-term issue of if you do rehabilitate them, where do you put them back? Do you put them back in a Gulf that's got hundreds of millions of gallons of oil in it and dispersants or not? And obviously, again, this was not just NOAA. This was the states. This was a lot of NGOs. Industry, obviously, is there as well. And then other federal agencies next. I've already talked some about natural resource damage assessment. As you can see, there's a lot of trustees, states, and feds. What we determined, I've kind of gone into, and there's a three-phase pronged approach, and one is pre-assessment. That's getting out to the extent you can before the oil ever impacts the resources to find out what kind of condition they're in at the time. Then out and doing all the sampling and science to see what the effect is. And then actually getting into the restoration phase. We're currently in injury assessment and restoration planning. There's a very, very prescribed approach, federal approach to how all this is done that includes everything from EISs to all sorts of public hearings and meetings to talk about restoration, the whole process. Yet keep in mind that as all of this work has gone on and continues to go on, it's all litigation sensitive. Because ultimately, the attorneys are involved in every step of the way, because ultimately, depending on how you end up settling with the responsible party, in this case BP, your ultimate hammer is that you can go to court, and you have to have a certifiable case to do that. And so it really puts a tremendous number of additional challenges in how you conduct science when it's all potentially embargoed. Next. So just as I've already said, you get to a point where you've made your case, you come to a settlement with the responsible party, and then you go back and you try and actually restore all those things that are injured. And we've been doing restorations. I think we have 300 or 400 in NOAA, but obviously restoration science and how you do it is an evolving thing, and there's lots of different kinds of environments that you don't just go and say, okay, well, we'll just reseed the grass or we'll put new marsh grass in and everything will be fine. In many cases, that doesn't work, and a lot of things don't work, and so it's an iterative process. The other point to make here is that as you think about restoration and you think about a case that might stretch out for years, are there certain areas where there's impact where you need to actually get out there very quickly and do emergency restoration to really stop further degradation or injury? So we have a whole component of this that's looking very quickly and carefully at, are there areas, oysters are a good example, oysters were heavily impacted here. We can't wait 3 or 4 years of oysters being gone to try. We need to start working right now. Next. The more we got into this spill, as I said, the more NOAA had to bring assets to the table. We obviously have research vessels. We have satellites. We have gliders and all sorts of other types of observational capability, which is routinely maybe used but not, like, diverted from all of its other missions to actually come to the Gulf and do this. So we had research cruises well underway doing a variety of things in other parts of the country. And as more and more and more demand came on us, we started diverting more and more of our assets to work in the Gulf. And hundreds of people brought people out of retirement, brought people in from every walk of life that knew something about working in science to try and assist us along with all these assets. Next. So this is what I was mentioning, challenges and public concerns. I've already mentioned seafood safety, a huge issue, a very public issue, and a very commercial economic issue. With 37% of the EEZ shut down, an awful lot of people's livelihoods was put on hold. Then you had the whole issue of Gulf seafood and was it safe, and the markets were just collapsing all around because of the impression, whether it was right or wrong, that oil seafood could get into the market. So there are a variety of issues beyond just protecting the seafood that we had to deal with on a daily basis. Pressures from all sides, close it, open it, open it, close it, what the hell are you doing kind of thing. How could you possibly come to those conclusions, that sort of thing. But in the end, to the best of our knowledge, no contaminated seafood has ever made it into any market anywhere from the Gulf as a result of all this effort. I think that's a pretty good metric. So fate and effect of surface and subsurface oil, I know any of you that looked at the news know what a controversial issue this was. One of the first times ever that we had an oil spill coming from 5,000 feet. 5,000 feet, it does an awful lot to a crude oil that you know something about in its original state before it ever reaches the surface, if it reaches the surface. So we had a variety of issues, not only with what's this oil going to do as it comes up through the water column, but how much of it is going to be dispersed into the column before it ever gets to the surface, and where do we go with the oil when it gets to the surface, and what kind of condition is it in as it relates to such things as how weathered is it, will it accept dispersant, how toxic will it be as opposed to what it might have been, so on and so forth. Huge issues that we're plowing new ground. You have tremendous efforts underway from a variety of different places to try and get those answers. Everybody wanted an answer yesterday, if not today, and some of the science wasn't there. And so trying to generate science on the fly and within a day to 2 days and get answers, we couldn't. We didn't, and we got beat up, both in the press, in the local communities, for not providing answers in an appropriate way. Short and long-term effects of the oil, again, because of the type of oil it was and where it was coming up and how long it took to get to shore, all those effects and the studies that would allow you to know very, very clearly what that is don't exist. And so, again, trying to predict and project what those effects would be, given all these other new conditions that we weren't used to, made for a very difficult slog. Human health, a big issue here. And as much a perception issue as a real one, quite frankly. There's an awful lot of study about human health as it relates to exposure to oil. And what I'm not giving, as I talk about this, what I'm not addressing are the stress, the socioeconomic impacts, which is a whole different game, and which we've also had to try and address. But the human health aspects, when you had thousands and thousands and thousands of people out on the water on the shore trying to clean this oil up and make sure that many, many, many folks who were not that well trained actually followed the appropriate protocol so that we didn't have too much exposure was a challenge in and of itself. And then, of course, the socioeconomic side, the impacts to the communities, sometimes complete destruction of the economies that these communities lived in, no clear understanding for months on end as to whether their Gulf would be dead when it came out the other end and their way of life would end. And so it just created incredible socioeconomic issues that were, again, we didn't have the best answers to try and address the issues and questions and concerns, and it really led to complex sets of mistrust, I think, and certainly misinformation in many cases. I've already talked a little about the hurricanes and the tropical storms. We had basically a city out around the wellhead, you know, thousands of vessels, tens of thousands of people. I don't know how many of you ever looked at the images or flew over the area, but it was incredible, the city of people responding out there. And basically the city said, we need 7 to 10 days of lead time if there's going to be a hurricane come through to safely dismantle this operation and move forward. I don't know how many of you know what the Weather Service typically predicts as a reasonable time that they can tell you when a hurricane is going to come through, but it ain't 7 days. It's a lot less than that. And so the whole issue of, all right, what does that mean in terms of the uncertainty that we're going to have to build into a prediction to get the evacuation in place if a hurricane is coming through? And then all the other issues what's going to happen to the oil. The oil, we kind of were able to predict after a while, and the currents would change, the winds would change, but we could kind of tell where it went. But when a hurricane came through, all bets were off. Not only all bets were off as to where it might go, but if it was going to come ashore, we'd had enough experience with extremely heavy winds and oil spills to know that the oil could be blown not only just into the marsh, but through the marsh and onto the other side, onto crops, water supplies, just all sorts of death and doom scenarios that we were trying to deal with again, just the magnitude of the effort going into trying to think through all those things behind the scenes is probably something most folks don't. And I've already alluded to this several times, the public access and information. Most of the experts were absolutely consumed and engaged day to day in trying to come up with these answers in all these issues. Did I talk about dispersants? I think maybe I left out dispersants, which is a huge one. Hugest one, and I didn't leave that out on purpose. I'm willing to talk about it, but we knew a lot about dispersants. We did not know a lot about dispersants applied, again, with oil that had come up through 5,000 feet of water and with the magnitude of application. The more we got into the application of these dispersants, and then, of course, the whole dispersed from the subsurface as well, brand new place, never been there before. Huge questions about what does all that mean and where is it going to go and what's it doing to the subsurface oil and how much we had all of us enough experience to say that if we could stop the oil from getting ashore, that was the trade-off we all were building a good deal of our decisions around. Oil ashore is a much, much worse problem than oil in the ocean. And at depth, if you've got depth where you're not dispersing oil onto the benthic communities. But when you start talking about millions of gallons of oil, we didn't have any background to really make intelligent decisions. And probably most of you don't know that at some point as we neared 750,000, 800,000 gallons of dispersing, we actually pulled together a team of experts from all over the world on dispersants, put them in a room and said, okay, guys, on the fly, We've all said dispersants are good. Are they good at these magnitudes? Mm-hmm. Or do we need to stop this? Do we really need to rethink what we're doing and rethink our premises? We actually had them, after 2.5 days locked in a room, come out and say, no, you should still continue to do it. So at any rate, there's other issues. There's all sorts of complexities. How much oil was spilled? When did we know that there was more than 1,000 barrels a day? And on and on and on. And I'm happy to try and answer some of those questions. Each one of them is a novella, quite frankly. It's amazing, the back behind the scenes thing. Last thing I would just say here is that I've done most every major oil spill, Exxon Valdez and so on, in my career. I have never, ever, ever had the involvement of the President of the United States on almost a daily basis in how and what I did. So the political interest and engagement from the White House, briefings every day with all the Gulf governors, the governors, not staff, President Obama actually sitting in on some of these meetings to listen to what we're discussing, incredible in terms of the interest and engagement of the whole political arena, which was a whole another layer of complexity. What else do I have here? I think I'll stop. I've already used most of my time. So I think most of you are aware there's a variety of issues that are still being addressed, that what I call the Mabus Report, but the long-term Gulf ecosystem recovery and restoration. There's a whole team that's looking at, okay, we had a huge spill, but the Gulf was impacted and has been impacted for a long time. It really needs some concerted thinking about how are we going to restore the Gulf with all the erosion problems, the water quality, the overfishing, the you name it. So there's a whole group that's working on that. The commission, I bet you've already had a briefing on that here. Yeah. And then the damage assessment. We don't know how long it will take. One of the huge unknowns is we've seen some immediate recovery. The oil seems to have gone away pretty dramatically. But what are the long-term effects from this much oil in an ecosystem with a lot of it dispersed and in the water column? It's going to take a while for us to figure all that out. And we really are on the front end of, I think, being able to make any statements about what the long and complete ecosystem effect might be. Okay. That's it. I'll call it good. Great. Right there.
Thanks, Dave.
One more logo for you.
National Ocean Policy. Blaze it all.
Our next speaker will be L.G. Holstein. You'll see from his bio, he's had many, incarnations around energy policy in general. I've worked with him when he was at the Department of Energy, and I think we'll hopefully bring a perspective from the Environmental Defense Fund's thinking on this question. L.G., do you have some slides? Or?
I do, and in fact, Dave, since I'm not going to use all of them, I wonder if I could switch seats.
Certainly.
With you.
David, you can say that. I'll switch.
Okay.
Yeah.
Too many Davids on this panel.
So I'll get to the slides in just a moment. I actually think you don't have my bio, although it's available with my jams and jellies out in the lobby for sale after the meeting. But I'm delighted to be here with this panel, having been the Assistant Secretary at NOAA, as well as the Chief of Staff at DOE. I've had occasion to work with both of these gentlemen who have great careers in public service and thereafter. And Juliet, of course, who I think we all know has developed a national reputation for her expertise in covering energy, environmental, and science matters.
Well, if somebody knows what they're doing.
Okay. Yeah, so let's just leave it there for right now, but thank you. So I just want to make a couple of observations. Before I do, I want to recognize David Burdine is here. David is rightly thought of by many of us as one of the prime architects of what we can think of as the initial pillars of America's U.S. energy policy, domestic and international. And really one of the great thought leaders in energy policy over a period of years, but especially and at a critical time during the Carter administration when I, for one, as a young congressional aide, learned an enormous amount from him. So, David, welcome, and it's great. I'm nervous just having you in the audience. As was mentioned, I'm a senior director for strategic planning at Environmental Defense Fund. And like others, including Dave, it took us in the environmental community, I think, too long to realize the scope and magnitude of the oil spill, and rapidly organized ourselves in a kind of a virtual organization to bring together the work that we do at EDF in our energy team and in our oceans team, in order to address all the many aspects of the oil spill. Clearly, the investigations that have that most of you have seen, or at least seen in summary, have all pointed in the same direction, and that is to say that there's plenty of blame to go around. In other words, that, as in the case of the Oil Spill Commission, that the problems, while the event happened to the BP oil company, in many respects, it happened to the entire oil industry. The commission went on to find that many of the shortcomings that they discovered in terms of the supervision and business processes used in the case of Macondo Well are, in fact, endemic in the industry. I realize that's a controversial finding on the part of the commission with respect to the programs of various oil companies, which whose safety programs are not identical. But nonetheless, it was a sweeping and, I think, very sobering conclusion. Clearly, there was a degree of complacency as well on the part of the regulators who over a period of many years came to think that any oil spills that did occur would be minor, would be small, and would be easily contained with very limited damage. What both industry and government must do now, of course, is to reestablish public trust and confidence. In the case of the regulators, public trust and confidence that there is a tough cop on the beat ensuring that the public's resources are being produced safely and that the natural resources in this case, the Gulf, are going to be protected henceforth from this kind of catastrophic disaster. I think that's a very strong challenge to both industry and government, and I'll return to that subject in just a moment. Clearly, in the case of the Macondo well design was a problem, but as the commission found, there were larger management and oversight questions both from the regulator and within the company that increased the likelihood that this disaster would occur. In looking specifically at the environmental components of the tragedy, we find that there are several aspects that deserve some scrutiny. One of which, of course, is the application of NEPA. And NEPA, of course, and its many regulations and its implementation by individual federal agencies can be a terribly complex business. But there's an excellent report put out by the staff of the commission just in the last few days that really does it's a great tutorial on NEPA, but it also highlights toward the end the confusion that existed, particularly within the Department of Interior, with respect to what kinds of information and reviews were necessary with respect to existing NEPA regulations, never mind any new regulations or laws that might be put in place. So I commend that to your attention. But in particular, a lot of attention paid in the staff paper to the issue of categorical exclusions, that is to say, what areas of the Gulf could or could not have been and what activities were justifiably insulated from more careful environmental review prior to drilling. And I think that's a subject that will occupy us increasingly as we go forward this year, in part because we're looking at oil prices once again in the $100 range, with growing demands for accelerated development of domestic U.S. resources. From the environmental perspective, of course, our groups occupy many different places on the spectrum of opinion, everywhere from some groups that believe we shouldn't do any more offshore drilling, others who think we should continue to do offshore drilling, but only in those places already open. But I think all of us agree that oil and gas will continue to be part of America's energy mix for some time to come. And if that means, and to the extent that that means offshore drilling, we have to fix the things that we have found to be wrong in the administration of the offshore domain and in the conduct by the companies to whom we entrust the job of developing the resources. The containment and collection activities, or the state of knowledge and equipment, turned out to be wholly inadequate. And there we see sort of a linkage between the failure of the regulator to require or the industry to produce the necessary amount of and types of equipment on the one hand, and the regulator's failure on the other to require that those kinds of assets be in place prior to any drilling. And so it was that the American public, and from the president on down, were treated to the spectacle of repeated efforts to literally invent and to build various kinds of containment devices in order to stop or at least to siphon off the oil that was spewing from the deep water. The use of dispersants was another challenge and a great dilemma, including for including for environmental organizations who have and continue to have great concerns about the additional environmental problems one may experience by putting huge amounts of chemicals in with the oil, and essentially creating this soupy mix you're all familiar with that traveled great distances. It was really only the fortuitous timing of the ocean currents that prevented the disaster from being even worse. On about June the 1st, the normal oscillation of currents that would normally have carried this toxic mix off in the direction of Cuba and then possibly north and west from there shut down as it would normally do at that period of time. And that combined with the warm waters of the Gulf during the approaching summer, allowed lots of microbial action and also contained the spill underwater in ways that otherwise would not have been the case had the spill occurred in winter. So if one can say we got lucky at all, we got lucky at least in that dimension. And yet there's so many things we still don't know about these impacts, and I'll come to those in just a moment. Drilling safety, obviously a big part of this, and previous discussions here at CSIS have dealt with the drilling safety issues. So I'll just leave it that issue aside by saying we wholeheartedly support the actions the Interior Department has taken in order to address the drilling safety issues. There is certainly an action agenda, but only some of that has been acted upon. The reorganization of the Department of Interior's responsibilities, which I hope will, among other things, address the interagency confusion over the application of NEPA. Second, the new guidance for those who are involved with drilling wells in the form of notices to lessees. And most recently, the announcement that they're going to form a body of advisors similar to what we have in the nuclear power industry to provide technical advice to the regulators. And that is critically important. We have it in numerous areas, including the nuclear waste program and many other areas, where there's an explicit recognition that government can't necessarily be relied upon, nor does it always have the resources necessary to keep up with the latest
technologies and the latest challenges in these industries. And if we can assume that offshore drilling is going to continue, but that it's going to continue in ever deeper, more challenging and complex environments, we're going to need to have both the technology of drilling safety, containment, and of course, responses. We're going to have all of that information kept up to date, and we're going to have regulators who are prepared to deal with company engineers. I think that's a healthy development as well. So what's the unfinished agenda? Very quickly, I think the unfinished agenda is that Congress needs to codify the drilling safety agenda that Secretary Salazar and his people have put in place. I think Congress needs to provide the funding necessary to equip the regulators to do their jobs in order to restore that public trust and confidence I mentioned. On the science front, I do agree with Dave Kennedy that we got lucky in a lot of respects in that large quantities of oil did not come ashore, but there's still some things we need to know. In fact, we learned in the case of the Exxon Valdez that it's critically important to have a long-term science monitoring program because the oil does tend to persist in the environment, and there are many things we don't know and won't know for several years, during which time we will gain information about the volume and pace at which young fish and other wildlife reach maturity. This is called, for purposes of the fisheries in the area, this is called recruitment, and we don't enough time simply has not gone by to reach any definitive judgments about what impacts there may have been on the ability of the fish in the area to reproduce. We need to proceed with more scientific work at EPA on the use of dispersants. Yes, some dispersants had been tested, including the Corexit, which was the dominant dispersant that was used in this case. However, even Corexit in the tests that had been done prior to the incident had never been tested on Louisiana sweet crude. So we need much better. I think this is an obvious issue of scientific protocols where we need to have a good, a much better matching between the testing of dispersants we use and the oil on which they may be called upon to be applied. And then finally, I'm going to finish with a couple of slides here on the one of the last subjects that Dave referenced, and that's Gulf restoration, because that is clearly, in many respects, the largest part of the unfinished agenda. The President said at one point in the course of this spill, when he went down to New Orleans, that he intended to leave the Gulf Coast better than we found it. And subsequently, Ray Mabus, and you heard Dave mention Secretary of Navy Ray Mabus's report, found that, among other things, we ought to go about a comprehensive attack on the degrading environment of the Gulf Coast. Think of it, as you will, in the same kinds of terms that we think of the California Bay Delta or the Everglades, which is to say these are critically important and, you know, large landscapes, or seascapes in this case, coastal scapes, if you will. And we need to do something about it, and we need to fund it, according to the Mabus report, and we would certainly agree that in this time of spending constraints, this is an area that's long overdue. And the Clean Water Act fines that are likely to be assessed on BP and its contractors at some point would be an ideal source of funding, if they're not siphoned off for something else, to have coastal restoration become a reality. This is a long-winded way of saying that the problems of the Gulf Coast did not begin with the blowout of last April, and they did not end with the capping of the well. So rather than talking about it further, I'll just show you some pictures very quickly, and then we'll hear from Juliet. These are satellite pictures, and the focus of this, of the next 3 minutes, is really going to be on a central element of what it means to restore the Gulf Coast and what's happened to it already. And for us, the central element, quite in one sentence, is to reconnect the waterways, the Mississippi River and its tributaries, to the land. In short, to restore the process that we all learned about in grade school in the building of deltas, river deltas all around the world, which is that deltas exist in a state of permanent conflict or contest, if you will, between the eroding effects of wind, tides, weather, on the one hand, and the enormous volumes of silt that get deposited at the mouths of these rivers on the other. And it's really that delicate balance that determines whether or not we will have a delta that can protect the city of New Orleans and other communities of South Louisiana, and can protect the fish and wildlife, not only for their own sake, but for the benefit of the many communities whose jobs depend, as Dave outlined, on healthy ecosystems. These slides speak for themselves, but the red areas indicate the amount of lost wetlands, in this case since 1932. And this is the rate, this is an average rate of loss, about a football field of land disappearing every hour. Where does it go? It literally sinks beneath the waves of the coastal region. This is what will happen if we take no action. And you can see that this is would represent a major vulnerability to future storms, including to the effects of climate change, and wherever you stand on that issue, nonetheless, an eroding coastline doesn't bode well. So 40% of the continental U.S. drains into the Mississippi River, and with it comes huge amounts of sediment, and that sediment is deposited out in three or four different principal channels. And as I discussed, rebuilds the land. I'm going to move quickly because I know time is short. Okay, so the next couple of pictures show two ecosystems that are relatively healthy with respect to this land-building connection between water, land, and the nearshore coastal environment. This is another satellite picture that shows the opposite of what's happening a little farther east, where the Wax Lake Delta and the Atchafalaya are depositing healthy amounts of sediment, not enough, but arguably in some cases, but certainly large amounts of sediment that are stabilizing those areas. So in contrast to the loss of a football field of wetlands every hour, here we see 93 square miles of new land since the 1970s. I'm going to bring this back to energy in just a moment, but the Mississippi River Delta is the one that really stands out. And this is the story to which I was alluding when I said the problems of the Delta preceded the blowout. We have built levees. We have built oil and gas infrastructure. And we're now taking the 120 million tons of precious land-building sediment, and this is what we're doing with it. We're shooting it out into the Gulf of Mexico because of the concrete and steel straitjacketing, if you will, of the Mississippi River, and it's literally disappearing off the edge of the continental shelf and not performing its critical land-building and life-sustaining and, I would argue, economy-sustaining functions. And yet the silt continues to come down. We spend large amounts of money dredging the Mississippi, and we're losing the battle. And we're doing that dredging, of course, for navigation, which is not just for the oil and gas industry, but for shipping entirely. And I want to pause here simply to emphasize that nobody in at least in the Environmental Defense Fund, is saying let's put an end to oil and gas activities or to shipping, though we certainly feel that this is a the blowout is a strong message that we need to accelerate our transition to a cleaner energy economy. But it is to say that there are many stresses on the coastal region, and we can fix the delta without doing away with oil and gas. So what this picture may remind you of is pictures you may have seen of the Everglades, where straight line channeling in order to expedite navigation or flood control has actually been part of the problem and contributes in a major way to the loss of the land. Again, back to the collapse. And here are some of the figures that Dave offered. 30% of the seafood from the Delta, 40% of the marshland in the U.S. is just in the state of Louisiana. And those dots, of course, are all the offshore platforms. And although it's hard to see on this slide, the green lines are the pipelines and gathering lines that bring all this production onshore. All of these lines make their way through the coastal ecosystem, through the marshlands, and we need to find a way, and this we believe can be done, to ameliorate these impacts, rebuild the land, and do a better job at designing the way in which we bring oil and gas production onshore. So let me, I think I could go on, but I'm going to stop there and turn it over to Juliet. Here.
We can just change name tags, and that keeps things moving along. Great. Thanks, LG. Our next speaker is Juliet Elferin. Been a reporter. Many of us, I think, have followed her reporting on environmental issues quite closely over the years. So I will make a pitch for her because I'm actually intrigued with this about a new book she has coming out, which I can't tell if it's metaphorical, if it's truly about swimming with sharks, because I don't know if that reflects your trying to do reporting in Washington, being in amongst a whole world of sharks, or whether it's really about sharks. So maybe you can let us know on that.
That's literal. I have a book which does, I was able to squeeze in a BP oil spill reference, to which of course concerns sharks. It's a book called Demon Fish Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks, which will be out in June. But so I'm going to talk, and I'm also going to talk briefly. My caveat is that 5.5 weeks ago I had my second child, and while I've deposited her at her father's office, I can practically hear her screaming from here. And and I have promised to leave a little early in order to pick her up. But so that said, I thought I'm going to focus on restoration and just maybe touch a little bit on some broader drilling issues. But you know, it's interesting. I spend a lot of time, going. I was doing both accountability reporting here in Washington, and of course going to the Gulf. And the thing, it was actually interesting. It was actually here in Washington. I met a lawyer who had been involved, had been working for the government for NOAA. In fact, during the Exxon Valdez spill, who said, you know, I need to put something on your radar screen that, you know, you've probably never heard of. I said, what is that? And he said, the Natural Resource Damage Assessment. And I said, you are correct. I have never heard of this. And, you know, but I thought the idea of how do you cope with damage to an ecosystem and make it whole really is obviously one of the biggest challenges that we face. And I did think it was interesting, David, in your remarks, that BP was not mentioned once in the context of NERDA and the damage assessment, whereas one of the most interesting things that I encounter, except I guess through references to potential litigation, which of course is salient. But one of the most interesting things that happened when I was on the ground and I was in the BP headquarters and meeting all the, you know, folks who were working night and day on the spill in the middle of it, was the issue of how are you going to conduct this assessment and how are you going to move forward. And I asked to go on a trip to go see just one of the surveys that's being done. And it basically, and I did end up going, although basically I had to fight and at one point call back to headquarters at the end when we were literally at the dock because there was an objection of that, of course, having a reporter come. And I think one of the real tensions that, you know, that the administration is struggling with is how does one conduct this assessment, both with, of course, as both of you mentioned, you know, the lack of a baseline of science, which I think is really obviously this huge challenge, particularly when you're trying to make some kind of meaningful analysis and try to get compensation about it, but also when so much has to be done in secret and when a decision has been made this time in contrast to the Exxon Valdez spill incident, where you have BP at the table in every context. And I think this is just there's no good answer to how you do this. My understanding, and maybe you can, you know, illuminate us on this, but my understanding is, I guess, back in 1990, literally Exxon had its own boat that was trailing the feds to try to guess what tests they were doing, but there was not that same collaboration, right? There you go. And so this time you have a decision to have everyone go out together. So, for example, when I went out, it was a team where there was the private contractor that BP had hired, Entrex, someone from NOAA, someone from Fish and Wildlife, and someone in this instance from Louisiana, because we were in Louisiana. And, you know, it was actually a very collaborative process. But, you know, this is one of these really tough questions that I think that we're going to see in the months ahead that, you know, NERD has been going on, and there hasn't been, to my knowledge, any information or almost any information disclosed on the results yet. And, you know, and there's just a limited access that outsiders are having to kind of monitor what's happening in terms of what's the data collection, what are the findings, and what does this mean, obviously in part because you are talking about the potential for litigation. But then again, you have this odd situation where BP is involved through Entrex in collecting this assessment, obviously funding a lot of the science that's going on. And I just think that, you know, this is something that obviously there are a lot of environmental groups who have raised concerns about this. And I think that, again, it's not like there's an easy answer to this, but it really raises some questions, particularly, again, when there is going to be a push, certainly, I would imagine, to get some sort of meaningful settlement. And, again, it's going to be years before we're going to have the full impact, you know, understood. And so I just think that that's really one of those very complex things. And as a reporter, it's just very hard because, again, while I got that snapshot and wrote about it based on that, you know, one of the interesting things is one of my long-term sources, you know, a scientist at a prestigious university, an expert on a particular species that's in the Gulf, I met with this scientist a month after the spill had happened. And the researcher said to me, well, so the good news is I've been hired to look at, you know, some of what's going on there. I said, fantastic. And the bad news is that I'm not going to be able to talk about it. And again, I find that interesting. The scientists had to sign, you know, basically a secrecy oath would be too dramatic, yeah. But basically had to sign, you know, a document talking about not disclosing findings. And, you know, again, so I just think that, you know, this is something that certainly deserves a significant debate and, you know, really hasn't been something that's been explored. The other real issue, and this gets, you know, when I heard that President Obama was establishing a Gulf Restoration Task Force, of course, the first call I put into was EDF, since they've been so heavily involved and really the leaders in talking about wetlands restoration in this area. But one of the interesting things is that the money that will be obtained from the natural resource damage assessment cannot be spent on long-term degradation, but rather just addressing the spill damage. And obviously, this is this conundrum. And while you had both the Presidential Oil Spill Commission call for 80% of the Clean Water Act fines that would ultimately stem from this incident to be spent on restoration, and Obama has echoed that pledge. A lot of the non-governmental organizations have endorsed this formula. You know, Congress would have to act on that, and it's entirely unclear in this atmosphere whether that's going to happen. And so I think one of the real issues in terms of restoration that, you know, again, that policymakers face is how are they actually going to be legally allowed to spend the money and, you know, what's the best use of that money. So those are a few things I wanted to put on the table. That, you know, there have been recent, you know, again, part of what you have is just findings that crop up and raise issues. So there's been a spike in the number of baby dolphins that have died. And again, there's just, you know, people are puzzling of what this means. And again, partially because, you know, they're actually, my guess is that it's actually probably a little better data on dolphins than some of the other species that are there. But still, you know, when you don't have as robust a baseline, that's really a question. You know, again, sometimes an individual scientist like Mandy Joy from the University of Georgia puts out reports about oil on the bottom and the impact on dead benthic organisms. But again, it's unclear because other scientists have not made the same findings. And so kind of the question is people are looking at different times, they're looking in different areas. Certainly we found that was confusing when we were dealing with conflicting reports coming out of science, in fact, on, you know, the extent to which microbes had or had not, you know, dissolved the oil. And so I just think part of the issue is you have tons of people working on this, and again, maybe a few years from now we'll have a better sense of it, but it's very hard to know right now. And then I just think, you know, there's also the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, which supports response to future spills, and, you know, again, kind of part of the question is how much of that can be used. So I think these are all, you know, looming questions. And just one last thing, just taking note of kind of what's happened on the drilling side, which, of course, first of all, could, you know, certainly has an impact on what kind of restoration activities you're doing. Clearly now the administration is operating in a different environment from what it was even last year. And so, you know, we saw Monday night the first deepwater drilling permit was approved. Obviously, Salazar has spent the last couple days on the Hill hearing how, you know, screwed up the administration's priorities are and how they need to do more drilling. There is a significant drilling operator, Seahawk, which has gone bankrupt in the time since the spill has happened. And while there were certainly other factors that contributed, there's no question that this was one of it. And so I think that one of the other questions is, you know, again, now the administration is going to have to be responding to, you know, what it's going to do on the drilling side, and that will have, you know, implications and will, of course, affect how much it can, you know, push for its other environmental priorities regarding restoration on the Hill. So those are just kind of some of the brief things I would say.
Okay, I'd like to open it up for questions. In recognition of Juliet's need to depart, I would say if anyone has a question for Juliet directly, please go ahead and ask it now. We won't let you totally off the hook,
sir. Sure, of course.
But if not, what we'll do is if you can, in asking your questions, identify yourself and actually try to get it around to being a question in case it might be a statement as such. But I'd like to open first, David, with kind of trying to draw some conclusions here. As you look at what we've learned in terms of the impact of the oil, and you mentioned many areas going into this where we didn't know what would happen because of the depths, because of the location and the weather, we've obviously learned a lot. But how much of this will transfer into areas that are different than that? I'm thinking particularly an area you've operated, which is in Alaska, which is very different conditions, and whether we have learned a lot to move us forward to understand what would happen there, or are the environment so different that we will have to basically try to arrive at those answers by other means. I know it's not a very fair question, but it's...
Well, and it's a pretty difficult, it's a complex answer to question trying to answer. But I think I would start by saying that when the Oil Pollution Act passed, there was a Title VII, which was a research and development and R&D component of it, that laid out kind of some budgets and an impressive array of academicians and other federal, state, local folks got together to talk about what was the state of science and what do we need to do, and we laid out a major research plan that would be 22, 23 years ago now that's never gotten a dime. And so we identified a number of the issues that are the issues that I've talked about here today 20-some years ago, not the least of which is a baseline for areas where you might anticipate so that you can very quickly begin to figure just what sort of injury you might be looking at. But it also deals with dispersants. It deals with models. It deals with spill technology. And I think I alluded to this, but the technology that was used in the spill is the same technology that we used in the Exxon Valdez, with few exceptions. We use a lot more dispersants. We burn some more, but virtually the same. And for those of us that have been in the business, I can tell you that the recovery rate that we expect from these kinds of mechanisms is around 10 to 15%. That's a good recovery. And I don't know in the end how much better we did here, but, you know, there are a lot of complicating factors that make it hard to actually get that figure right. But so the answer, every spill is unique. The issues were in Exxon were not the same issues here, and I go into those. But so it's difficult for me to say anything other than across the board, we are woefully inadequate in the amount of investment we've made to try and get better at understanding the science and or the technology.
Frank, and then, okay, start with Frank, and then.
Thank you. This is an excellent presentation. Very well.
So the first question is on containment and capture and how much it's advanced. And had we used things like oil-water separators earlier in the process before the spill was dispersed, would that have helped? And then the second question kind of goes to a point that you've all alluded to. We had Admiral Allen here in the fall, and he talked about how after Katrina and Rita, the governors and a lot of the local politicians were set up for one protocol standard, but since this was an oil spill, the Oil Spill Prevention Act protocols went into play, and that was one of the reasons that BP was so involved in the process. How much confusion did that put into the process, and how much more difficult did it make it? Thanks.
I'm afraid that's me again. So so on your last one, I've suggested that there was just so much misunderstanding, misinformation, and in the Oil Pollution Act and the National Contingency Plan, they're very clearly stated, from anybody that wanted to go look, is how you approach an event of any significance. And you have three parties at the table that form a consultative group that run the spill. One is the responsible party. One is the Coast Guard, and one is the affected state. In this case, a little different because it was in federal waters, and so you had MMS there. But very clearly laid out, we do all sorts of drills, and both regionally and nationally. We have a spill of national significance drill that we do every couple of years. And in all instances, when you have a command center established, those are the three parties that are at the table. In this particular case, it never early on, I think, was clearly elucidated to everyone in the outside world that BP was there for a very good reason. It's because there's a national contingency plan that says they should be there. And interestingly enough, over time, there was this artificiality that set in as a result of all the blowback from BP being so close, where they were held further and further at arm's length. So it was kind of an interesting reversal from this is the policy that the country uses, and that's why they're there, to that BP punch. You got to be careful with them, you know. So that's that issue. And in terms of technology, quite honestly, there's part of the reason is that nobody's got a silver bullet. And so oil-water separators, no, that wouldn't have done any good in my mind. And when you have an event of this size and magnitude, and if any of you were out there, you had millions of gallons on the water, but if you flew over it, that was not a big oil slick. It was spread out all over everywhere, and just trying to chase the bigger, heavier components of that down and try and skim them or do whatever, or for that matter, effectively apply dispersant. When you need to get dispersant on the heavy oil, and the heavy oil might be a little bit here, a little bit here, and a little bit there, it's just when you have something of that magnitude, for whatever reason, part of it's just not ever making the investment. I mean, there's got to be bullets out there. The technology just hasn't advanced. And so that's the answer there.
Okay.
Well, first of all, I agree completely with Dave's answer on the oil-water separators. I don't think they would have made a difference, but I'm not a drilling engineer or an environmental engineer even, so anybody can contest that, I suppose. I think that the but I'm with you. I think that the involvement of BP became both, and I think, Dave, your comments hint at this. I mean, it became as much a political matter as a technical matter. The fact of the matter is that BP was heavily involved throughout the process, not just because the law required it, but because they had the expertise and the government did not. And, of course, they were paying the bills for everybody and everything. In fact, we all recall in the early days when Ken Salazar on two separate occasions said that he had his boot on the neck of BP, and that was to demonstrate that the government was going to make BP do the right thing and stop the oil from coming out and contain what had been spilled. That tune changed dramatically when it became very evident through public opinion surveys and the media that, in fact, the public expected catastrophe of this magnitude occurs, the public expects its government to be in the lead, to have something to say, and to have some expertise. It, over a period of time, the government did have expertise that it brought into play, including the Department of Energy's use of X-rays to examine the blowout preventer, some of the flow committee, or whatever the full name of that committee was, that USGS and others were involved with. But a lot of that was, as I think the federal actors will admit, was improvisation along the way. And I think this entire discussion is all about how we get ahead of the curve. And that's really the challenge for us. It's the challenge for everyone in this room, anyone who really feels like they have a stake in this. And I think given the magnitude of issues that all come together here in the Gulf, that, in fact, we do all have a stake in trying to figure this out. And it has nothing to do with, you know, punishing the oil industry. I, for one, have been very impatient about all of the hyperbole about how the Interior Department has some secret plan to never issue another deepwater drilling permit. But the fact of the matter is we have to get this right. The American public demands it. And cleaning up after the disasters have occurred, whether they be Katrina or the oil in the marshes here, is not, you know, getting better and better at the containment and cleanup is not what we're after here, or at least it's not the only thing we're after. We're after the prevention.
And energy. My question is in regard to the formation recently of the Marine Well Containment Company. And if we might all agree that it's already a pretty complex environment in terms of responsibilities, and we might also agree that the focus should be in preventing spills. What do you see the role of the Marine Well Containment Company, and how do you see that operating with the different government agencies and potential conflicts of interest, different agendas, and the fact that it's, again, post-spill focused as opposed to spill prevention focused?
Well, I've already described in some detail the shortcomings and indeed the national, embarrassment and dismay over weeks going by while different techniques were tried, and indeed, in some cases, the techniques that were tried with those attempts were made with equipment that had to be manufactured. And even in the case of containment booms, which, as Dave correctly says, just capture a small percentage of the oil on the best of days, we even had to watch while hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of feet of containment boom had to be manufactured and rushed to the scene. I think the Marine Well Containment Company, as a consortium, was a good idea. And I think that it will help focus the equipment needs and maybe the protocols for the use of that equipment in ways that we didn't see, or at least ways that were confined to individual oil company plans and procedures. So I think that's useful, but I don't think it would be I don't think it could maximize its benefits were it not for the fact that the Interior Department has put in place in its notices to lessees 5 and 6 in particular requirements for equipment that can be demonstrated to be adequate for containment and that that equipment is work. So I'm looking forward to sort of a three-legged stool on this. One, the operation of those new requirements that are very technology-focused. Two, the marine well containment company to help develop the technologies we need and work with the oil companies or across oil companies to hopefully to share technology in everyone's interests. And the third leg of the stool, which I haven't really mentioned, I guess I mentioned very briefly, is the formation of this advisory committee to provide the sort of the help answer the questions. And this goes to your question about conflicts of interest, hopefully in an objective way, to act as a third-party entity to define the technical challenges that have to be answered with equipment and protocols and so forth. So I think, as I say, I think it's a three-legged stool. There is precedent for that last thing, as I mentioned, in the nuclear power industry, also in nuclear waste and some other areas where highly technical, and this is, as I said, going to get nothing more than more technical as time goes by, but I think we need all three pieces at least to address the range of concerns you mentioned.
I want to add one thing. I don't know how many of you in the room may be familiar with something called the Marine Spill Response Corporation. Exxon Valdez, oh, my God, how could this happen? Marine Spill Response Corporation, a major organization formed across all the oil companies, regional cleanup capability, skimmers, booms, a research and development budget that I think was at the $60 to $70 million figure annually for 5 years. and I'm not picking on that particular issue, but I this is an analogy, and it's one of the things that I, having been in this business for as long as I've been in, have seen repeatedly a disaster of some national import, everybody rushing in to save the day and show everybody how they can fix everything, no major event for 2 or 3 or 4 years, and complete departure from all fronts of investments and interest. And it's just happened over and over and over again. So there's one of the other huge challenges, I think, here is if let's learn a lesson and then try and stick by what we're going to do about it more than just for a couple of years until the next thing comes along.
Engineering, and it's interesting to me to see what's happening right now. You're talking about how we go forward with this on the question of oil spill response and our capabilities today. The Secretary of Interior has just announced that he has started the deep water drilling permits, basically, and my impression in that is that he has decided that therefore, the industry has proven that they are capable of responding to a spill. Because why else would we permit the drilling to go forward? It's easy to look in hindsight about what happened in the past, and it's obvious that we were so woefully unprepared for the kind of spill that the Macondo well offered us. Where do we stand today? What's the reaction by the environmental community to the announcement that we're going to drill in deep water again? Does the environmental community agree that we're prepared now, and as we weren't a year ago? How about the other federal agencies that are responsible for the environment? What is their opinion about this? it's interesting because I don't hear any discussion about that issue right now. And, you know, we're about to embark on opening up drilling again. And how better prepared are we, really?
I guess we're going to find out, Pete. Where are the environmental organizations? I really can only speak for my own. I think most of the environmental organizations, ourselves included, did not and probably do not have the kind of detailed engineering expertise that would enable us to have detailed opinions with respect to particular technological fixes. But we are used to examining government processes and the involvement of, and you really listed two problems. I see I'm losing my voice, so I apologize. But I think there are at least two processes underway. When the leasing is done, that's when you need to have an effective interagency process, as is detailed in this working paper released by the staff that I alluded to earlier regarding NEPA, coordination under NEPA. The well design issues and the equipment and response plans are primarily in the purview of only one agency, the Department of Interior, and within it, the newly reorganized BOMER. Couldn't they have come up with an easier name? At any event, so I think that the issuance of a permit, and ironically, this is a project in which BP is a participant, strongly suggests that those who say that the government was going to set the bar so high that it would drive industry out of the Gulf, I think that really lays to rest that argument. I think the department and particularly the secretary have done a good job of resisting the pressures from the oil industry and particularly from many sympathizers in Congress whose statements on this subject sometimes have come perilously close to suggesting that we ought to return to business as usual or business as practiced before. That is not, in my opinion, in anyone's best interest, including in the best interest of the oil industry. So in conclusion, I think, at least from our standpoint at the Environmental Defense Fund, we believe that development of America's domestic energy resources in the Gulf ought to go forward, but obviously under a new, a much tougher new set of rules with much higher safety bars, much more transparency, and much more input, including from the three-legged stool that I described. Do we have perfect confidence that things are all fixed and all ready to go? No, and I did describe an unfinished agenda, which included not only addressing the restoration before us to fulfill the President's vision of leaving the Gulf Coast better off than we found it, but also includes demonstrating that we will, in fact, have technology that can do a better job of monitoring the wells, give decision makers feedback in real time, and lastly, provide a long-term basis for trust and confidence that regulators and the industry know what they're doing and won't make the same mistakes again. It's not perfect, but I think it's a fair balance of interest that we're seeing take shape now.
Well, okay, if we have very quick questions, I was going to let David off the hook on answering the question about the rest of the administration. I don't think you usually like to do that. So if we can take both of them, are they quick?
Yes.
I can't control the length of the answer, but the questions. So. We never do that here. So.
Within several weeks of the spill, my name is Richard Dagey. I'm with SICE, Johns Hopkins. Within a couple of weeks of the spill, I had alarmed emails from colleagues in Bermuda and Norway. Next week, I'm going to give lectures in Havana, and I can tell you this is going to come up. To what extent was state involved, do we know? And to what extent were they communicating, liaising, or informing to eventually Cuba or to any of the other nations that might in the long run have been affected? Thank you.
They were quite involved, and throughout the course of the spill, especially LG was talking about the loop current, which did some interesting things that it doesn't normally do, which really saved a lot of headache and heartache. We were briefing through State Department Cuba on a regular basis as to the science that we had and where we where and what we thought the potential impact would be. They got regular routine briefings, and we continue to try indirectly talk with them. As you know, they're getting ready to do a little drilling of their own. So there's plenty of reason to be a little concerned about what the outcome of that could be as it relates to the United States.
Hi, my name is Monty Martin, and my question is regarding the estimates of the amount of oil and the change. They were wild. Like in the first couple of days, we went from 1,000 barrels a day, and I thought that was incredible. And I think it moved on to 3,000, then 5,000. And in the end, the best estimates was 20,000. And if you could respond to who was making these estimates and you know, I hope this is kind of a quick answer for that. And I think that that has a lot to do with the litigation involved is, you know, who's making the scientific estimate because, you know, the amount of oil. Anyway, thanks for taking my question.
The answer is I can't answer it in a very short period of time. It's very complex. A number of players at the table and everything from the uniqueness of where the spill originated and the technology and the information to begin to figure the appropriate way to estimate it. A lot of cautions about how soon or when we would begin to talk about more and more and more oil just because of the concerns about not being able to adequately address it and so not addressing it at all. A number of mistakes made in all of that, but in the end, a very complex mm-hmm. issue that until we got an incredible team together, you know, from Nobel scientists on down, to really sit down and go through all of the complexities and do the appropriate calculations, nobody knew for sure. And that really led to an awful lot of the misinformation and a lot of, I think, overly cautious initial thoughts about we don't want to scare the public until we really know more than we know, even though it's pretty obvious it was more than what originally got predicted. So it's a very complex answer.
But I think you did a good job of summing it up. So, well, I think we are out of time. David, Elgie, and Juliet in absentia, thank you very much. What I take away from this is a comment I think Elgie made that cleaning up afterwards is not the option you want to do. So I think that that really does focus our minds. There's so many uncertainties once the spill happens and the difficulties in cleaning it up. So I think in many ways you've really reinforced the importance of the safety programs to make sure we don't get there and have to answer all of the unanswered questions because we don't really know as much as we would like to. So again, join me in thanking them both for their presentations.